From WBUR Boston, this is Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Each week, we bring you the best of Boston University from the worlds of scholarship, letters, politics, and the arts. Tonight, we present the third and final installment from the annual lecture series, The Fascination with Jewish Tales, by teacher, author, and Nobel Peace Prize laureate Elie Wiesel. Tonight's lecture is titled, In Contemporary Writings, Open Heart. Introducing Professor Wiesel is the director of the B'nai B'rith Hillel Foundation, Rabbi Joseph Pollack.
There is a terrible moment that no survivor can forget that takes place at the moment when your sentence is passed. For thousands of children on the Kinder transport to England, for example, this moment was manifest when they said goodbye to their parents. That was when they no longer knew whether they would ever see them again. And it was the not knowing that marked the moment. It was when your right to parents as a certainty, as a given of life, fell away from you. It is the moment, to use another setting, when men, women, and children were separated at the gates of Auschwitz and other camps and did not know whether they would see each other again. It is the moment, if I may use a non-Holocaust setting, when the court has found you guilty of a capital crime, your sentence is passed, and your appeals begin. You no longer know whether you're going to make it. There is also what I call the other end. What is the chemistry between the Kinder transport child when he is reconciled with his parents after the war? What is the chemistry between husband and wife when each thought the other murdered in Auschwitz, each remarried, and now discover each other years after the war, inhabiting different planets? No one has examined this question with greater sensitivity than has Elie Wiesel. It may even be possible to say that in some ways, better than anyone else, he discovered the question and discovered its explosive consequences. A person being wheeled into the operating room for a life-death operation, it seems to me, will be facing this question as well. Let us listen carefully then as the master reworks this question yet more deeply. Ladies and gentlemen, Elie Wiesel.
Rabbi Pollack, you guessed it. You haven't read my book, but somehow you felt what was coming. But it's not new. After all, we have spent so many hours together since I came to BU, studying, exchanging views, memories, comments, fears, joys. So how can you not know what I was going to say? I could even actually say, and tonight, therefore, since I have a sore throat, you give the lecture. I would like to thank you, of course, for all the work you have done for Hillel and for our friendship. Usually, the third lecture, if I have published a book, is about the book, why I wrote it, what I wrote, and go into it. It's not about the Bible, not about Talmud, not about Hasidism, with all the modesty that I should master and conjure about my books, not theirs. So therefore tonight the lecture will be not about ancient times and topics, but about today's events. I shall use not texts forgotten and remembered, but pages from my own work. And as I told you, I do so only on rare occasions. In truth, I prefer to explore words written by others, old philosophers, commentators, and tellers of tales whose images and ideas fed my memory as well as my fantasy. These, to me, constitute a rich and enriching source of intellectual curiosity and mystical or quasi-mystical knowledge, without which my life as an internal student would be totally and embarrassingly impoverished. Just go to the library or the internet, which I don't know how to use, and check all the themes and personalities I explored here for the last 40 odd years. And like me, you will be surprised and even amazed at their variety, linked to scripture, Talmudic masters, Hasidic rabbis, Isaiah and Jeremiah, the Rabbi of Kotsk and the Master of Lublin, the words of the first and the work of the latter. I love them. I love their peers. I love the fear they inspired and the joy they offered. Nothing would give me the fervor, the taste of ecstasy that I felt and still feel when deciphering an obscure passage and envelop their extraordinary language with density and silence. Still, from time to time, usually at the third lecture, in the past I would bring to you something I had just written and published, from a novel, a memoir, or a poem, words that are truly meant to be gifts of a very special nature, offerings to very special friends. I consider all of you who really spent an hour or two with me a few times a year, students in the classroom or visitors tonight, you are offerings. So tonight, they will tell of a dangerous and painful period in my life from my recent past. And when I say they, I mean my words. To my generation, writing is no longer an entertaining endeavor, but an ethical obligation to bear witness. To what? To historical events? To outside or internal adventures? To personal emotions, aspirations, and/or metamorphoses? To the past only? Then when does the past end? And when has it really begun? Only a year ago? Only a life ago? Only a lesson ago? Only an encounter ago? Some of us have grown up with the obsession to remember the victims, believing that to forget them would be to betray them and to expose them to a second death. For not to allow the enemy to kill or to kill the memory of those who are no longer here has become, to some of us, a kind of secular motto, an appeal issued by a secular religion. Just before being shot by his former student, the SS commandant in Riga, the great Jewish historian Shimon Dubnov, appealed to his fellow Jews standing next to him, who were actually going to be shot the next moment. And he showed to them, Yidden, Yidden, schreibt und verschreibt, meaning Jews, write, write, write. Now he said that, he shouted that to his fellow Jews, who like him were going to be shot. Poems written by children in the ghetto, prayers recited by rabbis, questions about divine justice raised by the pious, and about the humanity of man by agnostics. Religious ideas and personal thoughts had their weight. Whatever happened in those places, in those days and nights, transcended time and imagination. That's about then, centuries, eternities ago. But what about today? If in normal situations many writers suffer from what they called writer's block, which means that they ran out of topics, their successors' dilemma are and were of an opposite nature. They had too many subjects. All of a sudden, for some of us, there was an excess of memory, an excess of desire, an excess of fantasy, and irreality and reality, an excess. They had too many subjects. They felt they could spend their entire life putting words and sentences together and still feel frustrated, if not guilty, for not doing enough because they don't know where to begin. With the children? The children. Whenever you think of that period, of that tragedy, of that calamity, the murder of children in the hundreds of thousands. Why the children? How about the old, who, like the children, were the first targets? And what about the killers? Who were they? What made them open to murder? And here at this place, we spoke about it so often, that the day I discovered that many of them had college degrees, and some of them PhDs. And you wonder, how could they? Those who absorbed in their classrooms by their good and devoted teachers, the beauty of a poem, the density of a quartet, the intensity of a phrase, or a picture, or a thought. How could they study in the morning and become killers in the afternoon? If ever I had faced and had to face a true despair on education, it was then. So should we speak about that? Should we speak about the metaphysical dimension of the human condition in tragic times? Should we speak about theology, which is a problem facing us day after day, hour after hour? We don't know where to begin, which one to favor. That is one of the aspects that make the today's writer so different from his or her predecessors. Because it means that the question is, what is the writer's role as witness to the present, which unavoidably become past? And this fear, this urge, dominate my latest volume called Open Heart, which is not fiction. But there is another book that appeared now, recently, very recently, and that one is not fiction. It's not realistic, but it is fiction. It's a novel. In doing both, I believe, really, that though we do not live in the past, the past lives in us. And that, friends, is the theme of the novel called Hostage. It's about a contemporary plague named terrorism. Clearly, it's not new. The terrible 18th century French revolutionary vocabulary had already contained that word. It was an invented term and personified by Dante and Robespierre. The message was horrible, but Robespierre was also a great, like Dante, was a great orator. He had style, and his public addresses were masterfully constructed and powerfully communicated. His late descendants today are not that gifted. Their language, brutal and cruel, lacks his culture. And I almost said his music. But in a sense, they go farther than he and his peers, such as Danton and Saint-Just. They preach their new religion called suicide murder, which is something which is a curse in history. Furthermore, he didn't believe in taking hostages. We can say anything about the French Revolution. There were no hostages. There were prisoners, innocent people being killed, great thinkers, great orators, yes, but no hostages. And here is therefore the prologue attributed to my favorite medieval author, One-Eyed Paritus, and he writes in this novel, "Can men be free? Can the eternal wanderer lose his sense of eternity as he gropes his way forwards through the forest whose huge trees touch the firmament? Will the child who is tirelessly searching for the old man in the forest to gather his regards of joy and memories of sadness find them before his years vanish in the midst of the grieving dawn?" Well, that is the story, almost, of the novel called Hostage. It happened in 75 in Brooklyn. Shaltiel Feigenberg, the hero, a professional teller of tales, has been taken hostage by two terrorists, an Arab, Ahmed, and an Italian, Luigi, whose background was among the clandestine practitioners of violence in Italy and Germany. Their goal was anarchistic: to obtain the liberation of three Palestinian comrades. That is the gist of the story. While in seclusion, Shaltiel relives his past. His older brother was in Moscow working in the Kremlin. Shaltiel himself spent the years of the German occupation in a cellar where he was safe thanks to his love for chess. Ahmed is brutal, unyielding. Luigi, the intellectual of the two, will eventually be the more compassionate of the two. The philosophical question which derives from the situation is timeless: who are we? Are we meant to be God's prisoners or victims on this earth? Are we his hostages, not his children, or at least associates? What are we doing in God's creation? In the Jewish tradition, March is written about liberating hostages. For instance, a halachic question, which means a legal question, and a psychological question, a moral question. Suppose both the father and the teacher are taken hostage. Who should the son or the disciple favor first? It's a very important question. And it's a terrible thing. The answer is the teacher. Unless the father is a teacher. And every father is supposed to be a teacher. In Israel, in modern times, recently, I think last year or so, actually, Israel paid a very high price for liberating one hostage. One hostage, Gilad Shalit, was liberated, and the price was 1,000 Palestinian prisoners. One life on one side, 1,000 lives on the other. It is actually simply because the prisoners were not hostages, they were prisoners. But the hostage taker needed ransom, and the ransom was human lives. Why is the story so important? It's because it shows a total opposition to hostage taking. Interesting, in Hebrew, the word hostage is actually ben aruva. But the word comes from arev, from responsibility. We are responsible for one another. When we say Kol Yisrael arevim ze baze, all Jews are actually, we say, mixed with one another now. We are all responsible for one another. But that means we are responsible for one another as human beings, not only as brothers and sisters and uncles. No. I am responsible, I consider myself responsible for every other person I meet in my life. Of course, above all, my students. My students, I hope, know how much I learn from them, more than they learn from me. And I only teach them the art of listening, how to listen. I could spend my whole life just listening to the whisper of dawn, to the cry in the night, to the song in the forest, or simply to a word from a beggar. So, what is happening in my novel, The Hostage? It's only a dream, Shaltiel says to himself, an idiotic, senseless dream, as all dreams are, inevitable and useless. Sometimes we dream because we are anxious and because we don't understand. I am walking in the mountains, in the midst of a crowd. I am moving forward and with slow steps. I don't know anyone. I have no idea why a strange instinct urges me to flee. Could the enemy be everywhere? I ask one person, then another, what are we doing here? A bearded old man replies, it's you I am looking for. He vanishes. A sad, dark-haired young woman replies, it's you who are waiting for me. She vanishes too. A man with a gentle face says, it's you. And they all assert, it's you. And behind them, it's odd, a stranger with an intense gaze nods his head and flashes a knowing wink at me. I know he's dead, but he's walking with the others, and he says nothing. And suddenly my heart starts pounding sadly and madly. They have all vanished except the dead person, and that's me. I'm alone. And the mountains narrow in on me. They become me. And in my dream, I say to myself, it's a dream. It's mine, not theirs. How am I to know? Oh, to unravel the fabrics of dreams and fantasies that inhabit the prisoner, to disentangle the time and duration that engross philosophers, the conscience of the ascetic, and the intuition of psychologists, the fire and anathema of moralists, so they won't turn into illusions and lies. Tell me, how is it done? And he is afraid. If he shuts his eyes, he plunges back into an unreal universe with people alive or dead. When he reopens them, the fear has not left him. So I describe this Shaltiel as the hostage. What is happening to him? Actually, his profession was teller of tales. That was his love. And that's how he made a living. He loves telling tales, mainly to children and to old people. And one day in Brooklyn, in 1975, he was kidnapped, taken prisoner by these two terrorists. And what is happening to him in the cellar, facing these two terrorists, is the story. Ahmed was brutal. Luigi was not. Luigi was an intellectual. He came from the left-wing groups in Europe, in Western Europe, in Italy, in Germany, the Red Brigade, they call themselves. And both of them actually were idealists. They wanted ransom. Three Palestinians who were in Israeli prisons. That is the story. He was convinced at that point he was going to die. In the past, Shaltiel says to himself, a pious adolescent, I would have known what to do here in this cellar. I would have followed tradition and asked to establish a small Beit Din, a three-man court. And I would have told them about my bad dream, and they would have exorcised it by repeating the ritual incantation three times. The dream you had is good, kalma tava raita. Wishing me peace, happiness, maybe forgetfulness and everything else. That was the past. But here I don't know anyone except the angel of horror. He wears the mask of the executioner. It was not an easy or a light novel to write. It goes from despair to despair. To be in the hands of two young men who believed so much in their ideal that they were ready not only to die for them, but to kill for them and kill him. And he really didn't even know why. Why him? Was it an accident? Of course it was an accident. But who believes in accidents? I remember Nikos Kazantzakis, the great, great novelist, who was also a kind of philosopher, and I used to see him. And once I heard him say, he quoted, I think, a saying by the Aztecs, and that's how it is, how it sounds. Quote, it is not because two clouds meet that the spark is lit. Two clouds meet for the spark to be lit. Which means everything has a sense. There's no accident. There's no coincidence in life. If two persons meet, even for a second, something had to be done before so that these two persons should meet at that moment. Therefore, there is mystery in every meeting, in every encounter. And I like the word encounter much more even than meeting. Simply meetings come and go. An encounter stays. The memory of it has meaning. And the question, of course, then, how far can they go? How far can they go with this victim without him losing his mind? At one point, the Italians discuss with Shaltiel a revolution. He was a revolutionary. A revolution, thinks Shaltiel, it's a noble concept. But a blood-drenched word. Its results are violence and transformation. It sparks the most human hopes and the cruelest loss of hope. And again, Robespierre and Saint-Just, Lenin and Trotsky, Bakunin and Stalin, scaffolds, guillotines, jails, the gulag, concentration camps. What do you do with all that when you are a writer? What do you do with all that when you are a student? What does the teacher teach a student? To give that student hope in spite of what they are learning together in the classroom? At one point, I describe my gaze, the hero of the book, was attracted in Lublin by a group of musicians who were forming a circle around a young and skinny bearded violinist who with a look of concentration was feigning to be playing. He was bowing vigorously and rhythmically, but his instruments had no strings. And during a pause, he said, I went up to him and offered him a drink. I spoke French, then English. He looked at me without understanding. I don't speak Polish. When I tried Yiddish, we could converse. He wanted a glass of water. He said he was from not very far away. And he wanted me to call him simply the musician. He was the only Jew in his group. I asked what he did when he wasn't playing. All sorts of things, he said. He listened to the rustling of trees in the wind and around here to the song of the dead, buried beneath mountains of ash. He had been in Krakow only since the previous day, yet forever. Time was important to him only as the rhythm of a musical melody. I told him that I had played the violin as an adolescent, that loved popular Hasidic tunes, which induced tears, smiles, and fervor, and joy, arousing ecstasy. I asked about his way of playing. It's the violin, he replied. I belong to it, whereas the other violins belong to the musicians. He had found his violin in a gutted Jewish house in the Carpathian Mountains. When I bent over to dust it, the musician said, it started to talk to me with a human voice, without trickery or stratagems. It begged to be taken away, to be cared for and loved by me. It couldn't bear living alone anymore, rejected by all. It was at the end of its tether, suffering too greatly. And when I hesitated, it promised to sing for me as no other instrument had ever sung. It would confide secrets to me that no other ears had ever heard. Its songs would give me my happiness and age-old dimension. And then I felt a chill because the violins had no strings. It was an orchestra of silent violins. Oh, I love that. I love that because there was music, but the music couldn't be heard. And there are times when the music shouldn't be heard. I myself played violin when I was a child. In those times and in those places, a Jewish mother always wanted her son to play violin, always hoping to become a Yasha Heifetz, after all, Yudi Menuchi. And we couldn't find a teacher. Finally, my father found a teacher. He was an officer in the gendarmerie. So I was introduced to the officer, and he didn't want to take money. All he wanted is drinks. So I would come every day, three times a week, in one hand my violin, and the other a bottle of Tsuika. Tsuika is the Romanian whiskey. He would drink and I would play. The moment he finished drinking, the class was over. So my father always tried to give me a larger bottle. And it was too large. But that's how I played violin. And I loved it. I stopped playing when? Maybe some of you have read my book, Night. And there I describe the death of my friend Juliek, who was in the orchestra, and the death of his violin. And since then, I cannot touch a violin. Now we come to the second part, which is open heart. Well, I had in my life a lot of medical problems, strange problems. Some of them lasted as long as my life. For instance, at age 7, I developed migraine headaches. Age 7. My parents took me to all the doctors, even to Budapest. Nothing doing. Because my father had headaches. My mother had headaches. My grandfather had headaches. So, of course, I had headaches. The day I entered Auschwitz, they stopped. After liberation, the day I came to France, they came back. And they are still here. every morning I get up with a migraine headache. I addressed so many medical conventions, and I always asked the question, each of them, tell me, explain it to me. They came up with all kinds of ideas, you know, all theories, but I still don't understand. What is it? That there, no headaches. So, what happened here is, I was in Israel for the holiday of Shavuot, holiday of the weeks. Came back to New York, and I had made an appointment with my cardiologist weeks before. So I went to him. He checked me out and he said, it's perfect, you can go and work. Go, continue. And then 3 days later, at night, all of a sudden, I developed a terrible pain here in my cheek and my jaw. Called up my doctor. He said, you know what, maybe you always complain that you have acid reflux. Go and have an endoscopy. I went quickly to the guy of endoscopy. It was 7 or 8 in the morning. In the middle, he says to me, my dear Ellie, it's not your stomach, it's your heart. Well, I never had problems with my heart. Went to my office. Well, I had a meeting with a group of Iranian dissidents. All of them actually were courageous men and women. And they thought I could help them, but believe me, I tried. In the middle, all of a sudden, telephone rings, and my doctor says, Elliot, we forgot it, don't frighten me. He said, we forgot certain tests, come. I said, I cannot. I have here 12 Iranian dissidents, and they need me, and I cannot leave them. He said, look, I'm your doctor, I'm telling you, we forgot certain tests, come quickly. And I said, I cannot. And we began quarreling over the telephone, I like an idiot. We made a deal, I'm very good at making deals, you know. I said, okay, at 12 o'clock I'll be there. Well, what could he say? He said, okay. So I continued my discussion with the Iranians, you know, strategy and how to save them, what to do for them, and so forth. At 12 o'clock, I don't know why, my wife was there. I said, come with me, you'll hear. After all, I have nothing to do, just a few tests, then we go home together. The moment we arrived at the gate of the hospital, boom, they were waiting for me. Quickly, an hour later, I was in surgery. Well, I describe it. A team of specialists is waiting for me in the emergency room. The very first blood test instantly reveals the gravity of my condition. There is a definite risk of heart attack. The doctors exchange incomprehensible comments in their own jargon. Their conclusion is quick, unambiguous, and unanimous. An immediate procedure is required. There can be no delay. My wife Marion whispers in my ear that we are fortunate. She had just learned that the surgeon who will perform the angiogram is the one who operated on her 2 years earlier, something with her heart. Okay, I remember him, a very handsome, strikingly intelligent man. I had been struck by his kindness as much as by his competence. I hope, he tells me, that we will be able to do for you what we succeeded in doing for your wife, to restore a normal flow of blood in the arteries by inserting a stent. But then he adds, looking grave, I must warn you, that we may have to intervene in a more radical way. We will know very soon. I am drowsy, but he gave me something. And fight against sleep by trying to follow the brief professional exchanges in the operating room. Actually, I don't understand a word. About an hour later, I hear the surgeon saying, I am sorry, I don't have good news for you. Your condition is such that the insertion of a stent won't suffice. You have 5 blocked arteries. If you are surgeons here, listen, 5 blocked arteries. Okay, you require open heart surgery. And there I am shaken. Sure, I know that these days open heart surgery is regularly performed the world over. I had met Dr. Christian Bernard years ago at a conference in Haifa, and we had engaged in a long dialogue on medical ethics, comparing Judas and Christian points of view. I had looked at his hands, wondering how many human beings owe their survival. But now the word open-heart surgery are meant for me, and they fill me with dread. Open-heart surgery. And I remember reading that when that happens, actually, the surgeon takes out your heart, and during the procedure, puts your heart on a table next to you. My God. That vision haunted me. When I say I touch my heart, I will have to reach the table, not inside me. Where is my heart? And what if it gets lost? A voice penetrates my consciousness. We are ready. So am I. Would you please count to 10? In panic, they are going to put me to sleep and I shall never wake up again. Not yet. Give me another minute, I said. Please, just a minute. The silence around us is unreal. Why? They must be surprised. I don't answer. Shall I explain to them that the practicing Jew, before giving up his soul, if he lacks the time to properly prepare himself, must at least recite a short prayer, a kind of act of faith, a prayer he has known since childhood? Too complicated to tell them that countless dying victims, martyrs, repeated this prayer before closing their eyes forever. I cannot tell them that. But I recite to myself, Shema Yisrael, Hear, O Israel, Ado Shem Elokeinu, God is our God, Ado Shem Echad, God is one and unique. Now I am yours, I said weakly. Count to 10. I think I stopped before I reached 10. Well, many things happened afterwards, many, many things. I had an open heart surgery, yes, and the doctors reassured me at least, look, the operation is a success, but we must wait a little bit, a few days, and see whether really you are all right. And then, you know, to be in the hospital, all of a sudden you depend on someone else for anything. I had visitors, naturally, my wife, my son, Elisha. Elisha didn't leave my bed for 3 days, 3 days a night. Elisha is my son, my only son. And then one day he has two children, he brought his little boy, he was then 5, and I'm in love with him. And he came, he sat down on my bed, and he said, Grandpa, I know that you love, that you suffer a lot. But you know that I love you a lot. Tell me, Grandpa, he said, if I love you more, will you suffer less? You see, I gave birth to a philosopher and a poet in his time. It was extraordinary. It was extraordinary because to regain life is being born, not once, but many, many times. The first time you can move your hand, the first time you can move your eyelid, everything is again the first time. Day after day, after day, after day. And then we started talking about going home. And physicians warned me that the feelings of weakness and fatigue that I felt in all my body would last long after I left the hospital. And so they said, for several weeks you are walking like an old man. Now, among the interdictions imposed by the physician, no smoking, I couldn't care less, I don't smoke. No drinking, I don't drink. No alcohol, nothing. No exercise. I never did exercise in my life. And then they said a bypass surgery brings with it deep fatigue and deep depression. Why? I don't know. Probably it is linked to many mysteries of the heart. In my case, I had a choice. I said to myself, look, I don't know how to fight fatigue, but I know how to fight depression. How? I began writing this book in the hospital. Because, look, I had so many problems, so many questions. Having studied the sublime and chantic texts of the prophets, I make mine Jeremiah's lamentations, evoking the destruction of the first temple of Jerusalem. And Jeremiah says something which to this day shakes me up. He says, quote, "You," meaning God, "have killed your children without mercy." We read this on Tisha B'Av, on the ninth day of Av, which commemorates the destruction of a temple. He said, "You, Hamalta velora tzachta, harachta velora hamalta." But he said, "You have assassinated your people without compassion." Look, I have written in my work a lot, maybe too much or too little, but my so-called problems with the Almighty. As someone who with all his heart wanted to remain, and I did remain, actually a believer, religious. I try to observe the mitzvot. And I'm doing it really not so much for him, but for my father and grandfather, my mother and her father. I don't want to be the one who breaks the chain, just like that. I do it for them. I simply cannot do certain things thinking of them. And I must do certain others, again, thinking of them. And I have written some things against God, about God, but I have never said what Jeremiah said. I would ask God, Master of the universe, where were you in those times of darkness and curses? We cannot conceive of God with or without. We cannot. We cannot think of those places if God is not involved somehow. Where were you? And why were you silent? Maybe indifferent or absent. You cannot be absent. I wrote all that. It is from inside faith that I write that. It's because I believe in God that I rebel occasionally against what I consider his injustice or lack of presence or compassion. I do that. But Jeremiah, you killed? Not you watched the killer kill. You killed? God is an assassin? Well, I can say, on the third day in the hospital, I felt the need to say my daily prayers. But I asked Mary and my wife to bring me my talit and tefillin, to thank him, to explain to God that I believe in him in spite of himself. My thoughts are still too nebulous to formulate a valid response on the subject of the Almighty. I do, however, find the response more personal, perhaps, namely, that my commitment is an affirmation of my fidelity, really, to my past. Oh, I know that this answer is in no way satisfactory or perhaps not even valid, but it is the only one I have. All my life until today, I have been content to ask questions, all the while knowing that the real questions, though that concern the Creator and His creation, have no answers. We are too weak for that. We are only human beings, not God. Maybe God knows the answers. Human beings do not. But they ask the questions, and that should suffice to have the courage and the wisdom and the nerve to ask the question. And that we can do. So I will go even farther and say that there is a level at which only the questions are eternal. The answers never are. And so the patient that I was, more charitable, repeated, since God is to be found in the questions as well as in the answers. By searching for the child that I was in the past, suddenly I picture myself as an orphan. I remember promising myself to watch over him, the child in me, even after my death, because the child in me reminds me of my father. And I've always thought of my father. Somehow, because I was close to him when he died, I was not close to my mother or little sister. They left me. I remain to this day always with him. In some strange places, I remember when I got the Nobel Prize and I had my oldest sister, she was the only one alive present. And all of a sudden, as my turn came to speak, I saw my father in the audience. There was the king and the queen and the princess, and the whole government, and the whole world watching through television. And all of a sudden, I saw my father. So much so that I couldn't speak. They were all waiting for my response. I couldn't open my mouth. It took me a long 2 or 3 or 4 minutes to shake myself up and speak. And here in the hospital, he was there again. Have I followed the advice of the Talmudic sage that it is incumbent on you to live as if you were to die the next day? And I thought, maybe I'm dead. Maybe he came to take me with him. If I'm dead, and I remember reading, of course, the appropriate text, which says that the first question the angel asks the dead is, were you honest in your dealings with others? And the other question is, did you truly live waiting for the Messiah? When will the angel interrogate me? Images rise up from ancient midrashic and mystical sources, crawling my brain and my memory. In my adolescence at the yeshiva, they used to make me tremble. Many texts describe the beyond. Few take place in paradise, most unfold in hell. The sinners and their punishment in the flames. Their deafening screams, their unimaginable suffering, which ends only with the arrival of the Sabbath. Am I, in fact, already on the other side? If not, would I have been permitted a glimpse into the beyond? I am lying on my hospital bed, but it is hell. My skin is ripping apart. My entire body is aflame. I see myself in hell, ruled by cruel, pitiless angels. My head filled with medieval descriptions of unimaginable punishments. I think I know, I do know what takes place in these dreadful abysses. Tears and screams fill the subterranean hells. That is the fiery universe inflicted upon sinners. Men hanged by their tongues, women by their breasts. I try to identify them in vain. Their faces are disfigured, unrecognizable. Is mine among them? And then my gaze turns to the others, the just, and they are imploring the supreme judge to show mercy to his people in exile. The ancestors are there, and I am there, but I am no longer alive. Which means, look, I have been thinking of what I went through, that in those dark times, I lived not only with the dead, I lived in death, day after day, night after night, alongside my father, with my father until he died. And of course, then my life was also a life in death. What then does one do? This is what I wrote about in Open Heart. How I described so many other things that happened to me before and what I imagined will happen to me later. I thought of the work that I have done. Was it enough? Was it real? I have written books, many books. At the very threshold of the great portal I feel I have not even begun. All the books, all the words said, written, remembered, have they really made a difference in my life and in the life of others? Doubts have invaded me. Maybe as one who survived that event with a capital E, I have not done enough, and therefore the world is still a dark place. Had I written well, had I told the truth with the appropriate words, the world would have learned, but it hasn't. Otherwise, how is one to explain mass murder still around, countries impoverished, killers free at work to do their work of killing, Rwanda, Cambodia? If that happened, doesn't it mean that I and those who like me tried to use language to save what we can in a world perhaps doomed? Oh, I question all my activities, for example, in my combat against hatred, which I wish to be unrelenting. Did I in fact invest enough time, enough energy in denouncing fanaticism in its various guises? Evidently not, since all of us who have fought the battle must now admit defeat. At the time of the liberation of the camps, I remember we were convinced that after Auschwitz there would be no more wars, no more racism, no more hatred, no more anti-Semitism. We were wrong. This produced a feeling close to despair, for if Auschwitz could not cure mankind of racism, of anti-Semitism, was there any chance of success ever? The fact is, the world has learned nothing. Otherwise, how is one to comprehend the atrocities committed in so many places? Human beings against other human beings. I have initiated many actions in countless locations with many companions and fought on so many battles. Was it all in vain? What shall I say to God? That I was also counting on His help? Shall I have the nerve to reproach him for his incomprehensible silence while Satan was winning his victories, while my father Shlomo, son of Eliezer and Nisl, lay dying on his cot? And suddenly again, it is my father, he too is in my room. Oh yes, in truth my father never leaves me, nor do my mother and little sister. They have stayed with me, they have stayed with me, appearing in every one of my tales, in every one of my dreams, in everything I teach. After surgery, as I lie on my bed fighting off pain, I review what I have accomplished as a teacher. For the past 40 years, I have lived among the young, and I fully know that I have received more from them than I have given. If I could teach them one last time, what would I say? The Midrash tells us that there is an academy in heaven and that God himself studies there with our masters. Some sources affirm that the Messiah is there, seated at the same table as the masters and their disciples. Will they allow me to join them? I am counting on my grandfather, Reb Dodye Feik, the Hasid, to intercede for me. And for the moment of joining them has almost arrived. I'm convinced of it. I feel it. Once again, I appeal to the memory of my parents and grandparents. Even though none of them ever reached my age, I should like to prolong my life by a few years, by a few months, or at least by a few moments. For there are so many unfinished projects, a study on asceticism initiated a long time ago, because the concept of accepted invoked suffering has preoccupied me since the end of the war. I would like to write some more about Moses, who remains our master, Rabbi Akiba, our steadfast friend, and so many others, including Maimonides, Rabbi Bachraim, Pekuda, the Baal Shem Tov, the Gaon of Vilna, Shushani, and Lieberman. I have so many things still to say, but I feel so much more I'd like to say on another topic. Friendship, for instance. I devoted a course to it at Boston University, a course that was most of all a celebration for friendship, contains an element of immortality. A broken friendship results in deep sadness, deeper even than what we may feel at the end of love. Friendship is my religion. I still felt I had so many things to do, and I'm not sure that I wasn't sure that I would manage to do all that. So this is really the book. And I wrote then a kind of conclusion, was a credo. Some of you are with me on my journey for many years know the elements of that credo. And it says, I belong to a generation that has often felt abandoned by God and betrayed by mankind. And yet I believe that we must not give up on either. Was it yesterday or long ago that we learned how human beings have been able to attain perfection in cruelty? That for the killers, the torturers, it is normal, therefore human, to act inhumanely. Should one therefore turn away from humanity? The answer, of course, is up to each of us. We must choose between the violence of adults and the smiles of children, between the ugliness of hate and the will to oppose it, between inflicting suffering and humiliation on our fellow men and women and offering them the solidarity and hope they deserve. I know I speak from experience that even in darkness it is possible to create light and encourage compassion, that it is possible to feel free inside the prison, that even in exile friendship exists and can become an anchor, that one instant before dying, man is still immortal. There it is. I still believe in man in spite of man. I believe in language even though it has been wounded, deformed, and perverted by the enemies of mankind. And I continue to cling to words because it is up to us to transform them into instruments of comprehension rather than contempt. It is up to us to choose whether we wish to use them to curse or to heal, to wound or to console. As a Jew, I believe in the coming of the Messiah. But of course, that does not mean that the world will become Jewish, just that it will become more welcoming, more human. I belong, after all, to a generation that has learned that whatever the question, indifference and resignation are not the answer. Illness may diminish me, but it will not destroy me. The body is not eternal, but the idea of the soul is. The brain will be buried, but memory will survive it. Such is the miracle. A tale about despair becomes a tale against despair. So this is more or less conclusion. In more pages is there. And of course I chose again, as always, as every year, the third encounter that we have is about words that I have written. And even now, the person of doubt that I am still not sure. All the questions I asked in this book, sometimes with silent tears, will remain mine. If there is an answer, you young students and your parents and your older friends, the answer is yours. And whatever it is, I accept it with deep gratitude. Until next year, good night.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard the third and final installment in the annual lecture series, The Fascination with Jewish Tales, by teacher, author, and Nobel Peace Prize laureate Elie Wiesel. Tonight's lecture was titled, In Contemporary Writings, Open Heart. Professor Wiesel was introduced by the director of the B'nai B'rith Hillel Foundation, Rabbi Joseph Pollack. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from James Trout. The executive producer for Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydotes. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us. From Boston University, this is 90.9 WBUR FM Boston and 1240 WBUR AM West Yarmouth. Also broadcasting on 91.5 WSDH Sandwich and 90.3 WCCT Harwich. WBUR, Boston's NPR news station and worldwide at WBUR.org.